Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So from the science of evolution, which we were just talking about with Richard Dawkins, to the politics of evolution and some more of the science, for a generation and really since the time of Darwin, we've been accustomed to thinking of our primate relatives as violent and aggressive. The war-making chimps explain the persistence of conflict. It's in our nature to be cutthroat and selfish, right? Well, my next guest says not so fast. He argues that cooperation and mutual concern play as important a role in evolution for our pre-human ancestors and are evident in our fellow mammals today. And that can have implications for how we choose to structure society, and that's where the politics comes in. He even has a theory of evolution and neoconservatives that we'll get to. Franz Duval is director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center and author of The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. And Professor Duval, so nice to have you back on WNYC. Hello.
I'm glad to be there.
Your book makes the case for empathy as a widespread condition in all sorts of animals. Where do you see evidence of empathy in the animal kingdom today?
Oh, there's lots of pieces of evidence. There's even mouse studies now on empathy, but it's, of course, more evident in, let's say, social mammals like dogs or primates. And the typical examples are high levels of altruism, that they want to do things for somebody else, help somebody else out. But also they're emotionally in touch with us. So, for example, your dog is going to be happy when you're happy or sad when you're sad. And actually there's experiments that have been done on that where you instruct family members to act distressed and then see what the dogs do.
Why The Age of Empathy as the title of your book? Do you see this as a particular evolutionary or political moment when we might be thinking more about mutual care than competition?
I think it's a political view that I have, is that since the stock market crashed and like a year ago, people have been discussing heavily issues like empathy and solidarity. For example, the whole healthcare debate is a solidarity issue. The Sotomayor appointment was framed along the issue of empathy by Barack Obama. And so people are much more interested now in moving away from a greed-based system to... I'm not sure that greed is ever going to disappear. I don't have the illusion it will ever disappear. But to move away from that kind of system to one that also includes empathy and solidarity.
Well, we're used to thinking about competition and aggression as essential ingredients in any species' quest to survive. So in evolutionary terms, what has empathy been good for?
Well, I think it originated with maternal care in the mammals, and so a female mammal needs to pay attention to the distress of her offspring when they're cold or in danger or hungry. She needs to react immediately, and that's the original selection pressure, which is very high, of course, very high survival value. And from there, it expanded to all sorts of other relationships, and empathy is actually evident in all the mammals, I think.
Now, I want to play for you a very short clip of Richard Dawkins, who was on the show just a few minutes ago, and I told him that our next guest would be you talking about the age of empathy, and I thought he was going to say, oh, great, empathy is so important to evolution, that great Franz Duval is coming on. Let's talk about how evolution is causing us to be nice to each other. Instead, he said this.
Well, I have great respect for Franz Duval. I hope what he won't say is that his evidence for empathy in any way undermines the Darwinian theory of the selfish gene. The whole point of the theory of the selfish gene is that it does explain empathy. The facts of empathy, for example, in Franz Duval's chimpanzees, is the fact that we need to explain. Selfish genes explain it. Selfish genes explain empathetic, altruistic individual animals.
So, Franz Duval, first, can you define for our listeners a little more than he had the time to what is meant by the selfish gene, and does your work run in an opposite direction than that?
No, I don't think there's any conflict, and actually I've debated this with Richard Dawkins not so long ago. I don't think there's a conflict in the sense that at the genetic level in evolution, yes, everything needs to serve a purpose, and you wouldn't do anything that is not in your own interest one way or another. Once these mechanisms come into existence, so let's say empathy evolved along maternal care and then was expanded from there to other relationships, once these mechanisms exist, they can be applied outside of these immediate relationships. And so sometimes empathy is applied in situations. For example, we may be empathic with a stranded whale. Now, that's, of course, not why empathy evolved in the human species. But once we have the capacity for empathy, we can apply it to objects outside of our immediate interest. And so I don't think there's really a conflict. I do believe that things evolved for a purpose, and that's what the selfish gene theory is about. But once they exist, they have a wider range of application.
You have a piece on the Huffington Post ruminating on the recent discovery of Ardi, Ardipithecus, the hominid ancestor a million years older than Lucy, who was recently unveiled to the public. Can you give us your take on Ardi and what you think she tells us about ourselves?
I think the interesting thing of Ardi is that the canine teeth, were smaller than people had expected. People have this image of our ancestor as an aggressive, warlike creature, meaning that they would need big teeth, just like chimpanzees have, to attack their enemies. And the fact that Ardi had smaller canine teeth has been taken to mean that species was actually more peaceful than we now assume. And I believe it's interesting that we have an equally close relative, and the chimpanzee is one of them, but the bonobo is the other one. And the bonobo is a very peaceful, hippie-like primate that makes love and doesn't make war. And people often ignore the bonobo, but actually I think the discovery of Ardi indicates that maybe our last common ancestor was more bonobo-like and a more peaceful creature than we have assumed.
Everybody who I've heard talk about Ardi talks about those teeth. Can we really learn so much about evolution just from one fossil's teeth?
Yeah, the problem is, of course, that they found a female, and I would want to see the dentition of a male Ardi, you know. That's the first thing.
The dentation, meaning the teeth, yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing is that we have always assumed that the reduction of canine teeth has to do in humans with the invention of weapons, and that we basically, our weapons replaced the teeth. And it is true that Ardi was not a stone tool user, and so we don't assume that that species had very effective fighting weapons. But all of these things still need to be resolved, and so it is all speculative, you know?
Was she vegetarian?
That's a bit unlikely, because chimpanzees and humans and even bonobos, they eat meat.
In writing about Ardi, you say that neoconservatives, love the standard theory of aggressive, warmongering ancestors because it lends support to a dog-eat-dog, or I guess chimp-eat-chimp, worldview. Why haven't these other ideas of the peaceful bonobos or the elephants who care for each other taken hold in the public imagination as much?
Yeah, I think there's a sort of ideological bias which came after World War II, where people started to talk about killer apes, and we are killer apes, and then the chimpanzee was discovered to kill their neighbors, and so everything sort of fell into place. Our close relatives do it, and we do it. And everyone fell in love with that kind of theory, partly because we had just the war behind us, and people had been killing each other on a large scale. And so it became a very popular idea, and as a result, there was a neglect of the cooperative tendencies and the empathic tendencies that we find in our species and in other species. And it's only now, I think, now there's increasing research on empathy in humans and cooperation in humans, and also a lot of it in animals. It's only now that we're getting interested in the other side of our species.
So is your main point that if we understand our species and other species as innately cooperative or altruistic, that will form a different type of society, that people will be less likely to throw up their hands and say, human nature is selfish?
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. It's in the sense that our nature is selfish and competitive, and we will never get rid of that. But to base a whole society on the idea that greed is good and that competition is good, which is really what we have done for the last 30 years, ever since Reagan and Thatcher, basically, is a very narrow view of the human species. And sometimes nature is implied in it. People will say, well, that's how nature works. Look at nature's struggle for survival. That's how we need to, that's what we need to mimic in society. And I'm saying that, yes, there is a struggle for survival in nature, but there's also an enormous amount of cooperation in some animals, and we happen to descend from cooperative animals, and we should be taking that into account too.
What's the elephant story?
Oh, we do at the moment research on elephants to see how they care for each other and how they are interested in each other. And they're actually very empathic animals. And with elephants, we also do studies on mirror self-recognition and what kind of level of self-awareness we have. And as a result, if you have these higher levels of self-awareness, as you find in elephants and dolphins and apes, you get more complex forms of empathy. And so they have helping responses that are quite a bit more complex than you find in your average mammal.
And you even see implications here for the current healthcare debate, yes?
Well, the healthcare debate is a bit of a debate about the level of solidarity and the level of empathy in society. If we are disturbed because we hear the story of people who lost all their money or who lost a loved one because the insurance company didn't want to take care of them, when we respond to that, that's an empathic response. And so, yes, the healthcare debate is motivated to some degree by solidarity and empathy, the same way the abolishment of slavery in this country was motivated to some degree by empathy. And, for example, Lincoln was very upset when he had seen shackled slaves, and this bugged him so much that he wanted to abolish slavery. And so empathy is very often involved in political debates.
Even in an evolutionary sense, as opposed to the moral sense, there's an impetus to provide health care for all. You're really saying that.
Yeah, I think empathy is too narrow a basis so empathy is involved in the decision and drives us emotionally. But when you make a decision on, let's say, the economy or healthcare or education, you also need to take selfish factors into account, like what is the best for our country, what is the best for everybody in this economy. And so you cannot base all of that simply on empathy. I'm not advocating this, but you also need to have some sort of argument. For example, if the U.S. spends twice as much as France on healthcare per capita, which it does, and it doesn't get as good a health care as the French, well, then there's an economic problem also.
Do you think it was an accident in terms of the way our thinking evolved that Darwinism and the Industrial Revolution came on the scene at much the same time?
Well, Darwin was, I think, to some degree inspired by the Industrial Revolution because people were talking about how good competition was at the time. And so I think Darwin got some inspiration from it. And Darwin himself was a very empathic person. Not everyone knows that. But, for example, Darwin abandoned his studies in medicine because he couldn't stand seeing people suffer. And so he was a very empathic person, and he believed empathy and sympathy were very important factors. But at the same time, there were political philosophers like Spencer who gave us social Darwinism and told us that since nature is a gladiator show where one animal kills another, that's how we need to structure society.
So you think the next time we're with a particularly crass friend or a colleague and we're tempted to say, God, you're acting like an ape, that would be unfair to the apes?
Yeah, I think that's definitely unfair. I think the apes act sometimes aggressively, but much of the time they're quite cooperative.
Franz De Waal, director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. He's the author now of The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, our word geek, Aaron McKean, who's coming by every day this week to talk about a word in the news. Today, it's going to be a set of words related to H1N1. Stay with us.